Hey, strangers, before we jump into today's episode, just a note to let you know that my new contract with my ad seller requires 4 ad breaks per episode now. I am doing my best to make the episodes longer to accommodate. I know no one loves ads, but them's the breaks in capitalism. Remember, there are a few options if you want to skip the ads. You can always do it manually, or you can now subscribe through Apple Podcasts and become a casual stranger where you'll get early and ad-free regular episodes, plus the new Strange News Weekly Addendum. Or you can sign up on Patreon at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $8 a month, you'll get early and ad-free Strange, plus all the other amazing content at Grabbag, all ad-free. We have 3 regular weekly shows and a whole handful of quarterly miniseries and bi-weekly shows, all for just $8 a month. See you there, and enjoy. What happens when the unthinkable is done? If a person achieves infamy before their 18th birthday, what does life hold for them after that? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. This is part 2 of an episode that saw 2 young girls who were a match made in hell, but who called themselves heavenly creatures, commit a terrible murder. If you haven't listened to episode 1, what are you even doing with your life? Go back and listen so you can get all the tea leading up to this episode where we see our real-life Velma and Roxy go to trial and look at what happens after the fall. To recap, on June 22, 1954, in Christchurch, New Zealand, Honora Parker died a sudden and violent death at the hands of her teenage daughter, Pauline, and Pauline's best friend, Juliet. The two had bludgeoned her to death with a brick inside a stocking that Pauline had concealed in her purse and brought with the intention of killing her mother. The girl said the death was an accident, but the scene of the crime told police a different story. After all, it's one thing to fall and hit your head once. It's quite another thing to fall and hit your head 45 times. Pauline tried to claim sole responsibility, but the police felt strongly that Juliet was involved, and she eventually admitted her part in the murder. Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume were put on trial in August of 1954. The trial was a sensational affair with lurid speculation about the girls' possible lesbianism, because Lord knows lesbians are dangerous, and additional speculation that they were both insane. Because a pile of evidence linking them to a violent murder was not enough, folks. It was also necessary to make sure people knew the criminals were vile lesbians to further impugn their character and to make the case that they were social pariahs. It's so sad to me that this was a point of argument in this trial when it was sorely beside the point, except maybe as an argument for not forcing people to deny their nature or for not shaming people for who they love. But it was just too juicy. Mad teen lesbians murder mother in cold blood. That must have sold some papers. The murder was plenty sensational all on its own, as the trial would reveal. Pauline's prolific diaries were entered as evidence and referenced throughout the trial to show premeditation and to reveal the morbid nature of the girls' relationship and their wild imaginings. Her journal revealed that Pauline first wrote of her mother dying as early as February 1954 when she wished her mother would die, but then began writing of actually killing her on April 28, 1954. She did not share this plan with Juliet until several months later. She just kind of rolled the idea around, dehumanizing her mother in the process, writing, "Suddenly, a means of ridding myself of the obstacle occurred to me." Then, she and Juliet began planning her mother's murder together in early June 1954. By June 19th, she felt they were ready to put their plan into action. She wrote, "We practically finished our books today, and our main like for the day was to murder mother." It's weird and kind of darkly comical that Pauline wrote the word murder this way, using an old-timey, even in the late 1950s, gangster way of saying it. Perhaps it was a subconscious way of distancing themselves from the actual violence of murder. Moida was cutesy. Murder was not. Pauline went on to say, "This notion is not a new one, but this time it is a definite plan which we intend to carry out. We have worked it all out and are both thrilled with the idea. Naturally, we feel a trifle nervous, but the anticipation is great." The girls originally planned on killing Honora using a sandbag, but discarded that idea in favor of using a brick wrapped in a stocking. Maybe it seemed more elegant, I don't know. I'm trying to imagine the kind of purse you'd have to carry to lunch if you wanted to conceal a sandbag. Also, how would you even kill someone with a sandbag? Never mind, I don't want to know. Pauline and Juliet felt killing Honora in a secluded area was the way to go and decided to have Honora take them on an outing to Victoria Park where they would use the brick to beat her about the head and kill her. This detail makes me very sad. I wonder if Honora was touched or even delighted to be asked by her daughter to go out to tea that day. Like, it feels so cruel, given their strained relationship and their struggles in the preceding year, to offer this seeming gesture of kindness and desire for closeness, and to have it be a monstrous lie and terminal betrayal. Poor Honora. Strangers, it is swampy out there, and your bedroom temperature has a huge impact on your sleep quality. Lucky for me and my husband, we sleep on Miracle-Made sheets, so we both sleep at our perfect temperature even though he sleeps cold and I sleep hot. Is it magic? No, it's science. Miracle-Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature-regulating so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Not only that, but the sheets prevent 99% of bacteria growth. So not only are you not laying in your own sweat and filth, but you're doing three times less laundry than with traditional sheets. Upgrade your sleep as the weather heats up. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle-Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo STRANGE at checkout, you'll get a free three-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/strange and use the code STRANGE to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/strange to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Pauline couldn't wait for the day to come. The night before the murder, she wrote in her diary, "I feel very keyed up, as if I was planning a surprise party." Then, the next morning, the day of the murder, she wrote, "I felt very excited, and the night before Christmassy last night. Did not have pleasant dreams, though. I am about to rise." Night before Christmassy. How delightful. Once they were standing trial, the only real defense that could be made that stood a chance of exonerating the girls was insanity. The defense introduced the concept of a folie à deux, a delusion or mental disorder affecting two or more individuals more or less identically. Two reported cases of this condition were presented with a brief review of the literature explaining that the majority of patients with folie à deux require multiple treatments including separation, antipsychotics, individual and group therapy, and family therapy. But to get all that, the condition has to be recognized and acknowledged, which obviously had not happened. Not only had the girls not been separated, but in the weeks leading up to the murder, they spent every hour of every day and night together in the hopes, basically, that they might get each other out of their systems before Juliet was set to move to South Africa. The defense attorneys described the girls as elated paranoiacs who shared the most minute details of their fantasies with each other. They created a world open only to the two of them, and the attorneys said, quote, "In that world, they were even more special than they themselves in their most grandiose egoism had previously imagined," end quote. Pauline's attorney, Alec Hoslem, argued, quote, the two girls had seen Pauline's mother as a threat to their remaining together, a threat they felt they had to remove. We have these girls planning their dreadful act, carrying it out so clumsily, and then, after it was over, not showing any remorse, end quote. I'm no lawyer, but I am really not sure how that argument comes across in favor of the defendants. I guess the defense really didn't have much to go on, but making the argument they were so bad at murdering and don't even feel bad about it doesn't feel like the right approach. There was expert testimony regarding Pauline and Juliet's mental state. Quote, in the opinion of psychiatrists Mr. Medlicott and Dr. Bennett, the girls' contempt for the Bible and belief in a fourth world paradise were evidence of insanity. The jury were told that the pair thought they were morally right in killing Honora. The girls suffered from paranoia, delusions of grandeur, and delusions of ecstasy. Each affects the other and aggravates the process of the disease. Juliet's mother would testify that she believed her daughter still did not fully understand what she had done, end quote. If not believing in the Bible is indication of insanity, paint me crazy. Again, not the best argument, in my humble opinion, but what do I know? Claims of the girls' insanity were obviously countered by the prosecution, who said that the psychiatrists had contradicted their own evidence under cross-examination. They argued, quote, this plainly was a cold, callously committed and premeditated murder committed by two highly intelligent and perfectly sane girls. They are not incurably insane. My submission is that they are incurably bad, end quote. Incurably bad is my new band name. It also didn't help their case that upon her arrest, Juliet stated, I would have been an absolute moron not to know murder was against the law. Interestingly, a 2011 article in the New Zealand Herald wrote, quote, examining the case more than 50 years on, Auckland forensic psychiatrist Ian Goodwin says he has no doubt the girls were quite mad, convinced they were superior beings living in a world of their own creation. But if assessed today, their mental diagnoses would probably be different, as specialists were more likely to take into account more their stage of development, he said. I think they would be a bit more understanding in terms of what we know about adolescent brains. All 15-year-olds are narcissistic. It's a bit dangerous to apply adult psychological concepts to young adults, he told APNZ, end quote. Whether or not they could be accurately deemed insane, Juliet and Pauline's behavior during and after the trial did not help them. They did not stand out as people who felt remorse or guilt for what they did. Juliet's brother Jonathan, in an interview many years later, said of their behavior, it was all rather jolly. I don't think she really understood the seriousness of what she was doing. When it came to the trial, the giggling and whispering and flirting and nodding to each other in court, that showed that the seriousness of what had happened and the seriousness of where they were had escaped them. An article from New Zealand Women's Weekly said it unequivocally, quote, the girls showed no remorse after their arrest and continued to believe they were beyond the laws of common men. A female constable who cared for them during the trial said, they would act as if they were above all this. And an article from the New Zealand Herald recounted, quote, the female police officer who escorted them from the court was shocked to overhear Juliet whisper to Pauline, the old girl took a bit more killing than we thought. When the officer took her to task over the remark, Juliet jeered back, oh, aren't we the perfect little policewoman? So, yeah, not very remorseful. This kind of behavior made it into the press, obviously, alongside everything else. The folie à deux argument, the ages of the defendants, the nature of the crime, the rumored nature of their relationship, etc. And the result was widespread media coverage and a nation of looky-loos following along. There were so many looky-loos, in fact, that finding a jury who hadn't heard of the case was pretty much impossible. When the prosecutor made his opening statement, he took time to address the jury regarding the infamy of the case. Quote, most of you will have read in the newspapers and no doubt discussed among your friends the story of this crime. A good deal of the evidence has already been given throughout New Zealand, I am given to understand, even overseas. The circumstances of this crime are unusual and indeed unique. To say the least, it is extremely rare that two girls of the age that these two are should stand charged with murdering the mother of one of them. Because of the unusual circumstances, the case has been given a considerable amount of publicity, and it would be foolish to suppose that you know nothing of the evidence, and therefore you may have formed opinions upon it. One of my duties is to ask you to endeavor to forget all you have read or heard about this case, and it is your duty to do so. You are here to decide the case on the evidence, and on the evidence alone, that you will hear in court. The dead woman was the mother of the girl Parker, and was brutally done to death. And as far as one can see, she has done nothing to deserve her awful fate. On the other hand, the two girls now occupying the center of stage are in a very difficult and distressing position, and the result of this trial may have dire consequences for them. I ask you to try to forget about these matters altogether. You may pity the dead woman and be incensed against these young persons in the dock, or you may feel pity for the accused in the dreadful situation they find themselves in today. These things have nothing to do with this trial at all. Sentiment and emotionalism have no part in British justice. Your duty is to deal with the case on the facts and not allow your judgment to be swayed by feeling either for the dead woman or the two accused. All you are concerned about is to decide whether or not they killed the unfortunate Mrs. Parker and whether or not they intended to do so. The evidence will be that the two girls came to the conclusion after much thought that the mother of one of them, Parker, was an obstacle in their path, that she thwarted their desires, and that she should be done away with. They planned to murder her and put their plan into effect by battering her over the head with a brick encased in a stocking. End quote. Honestly, though, stranger, I don't think he needed to worry about people feeling sorry for the defendants. They were so effectively demonized that if any bias existed, I don't think it was in their favor. Strangers, did you know you can totally enjoy THC right out in the open at your uptight family's barbecue this summer? With Cornbread Hemp's delicious flavored seltzers, they never have to know that your fizzy summer drink has just the right amount of THC to keep your head cool, even if temperatures are rising or your family's horrible politics are making you want to scream. With four delicious flavors to choose from, blueberry breeze, peach iced tea, raspberry limeade, and salted watermelon, and with just 30 calories and 5 grams of sugar, and no synthetics, the only thing you'll have to worry about is your Uncle Bob trying to steal them. Finally, a seltzer that tastes and feels amazing. It's perfect for spring and summer. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% off their first order and enjoy free shipping on orders over $75. Head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange, code STRANGE. Cornbread Hemp. This is the good life. Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume were convicted of Honora Parker's murder on the 28th of August, 1954. They were too young to be considered for the death penalty, so were instead given indefinite sentences. Each spent 5 years in prison and were granted parole in December of 1959. Pauline went to prison in Christchurch while Juliet served her sentence at Mount Eden Prison in Auckland. Some sources say they were released on the condition that they never contact each other again, but Sam Barnett, the Secretary for Justice at the time, told journalists there was no such condition. Even so, they were not allowed contact with each other while incarcerated. The article in the New Zealand Herald commented on this, saying, quote, "The parole board said the murder was the result of a one-in-a-million chance friendship that went terribly wrong. Effectively, had they never met, Honora would still be alive," end quote. The Herald also reported that neither girl was provided with psychiatric help or any sort of rehabilitation services while they were incarcerated. Juliet Hume's release in 1959 was unconditional, and she immediately left New Zealand to rejoin her father in Italy and then later moved to England. Pauline Parker was placed on 6 months parole in New Zealand and then had a conditional release until 1965, after which she also left the country and moved to England. Both girls took on new names. Pauline became Hillary Nathan, while Juliet became Anne Perry. And you would expect such a remarkable and fraught story to end there. But, stranger, that was not the case. Even though Juliet moved and became Anne Perry, she did not drift into obscurity and lead a quiet life, as one might expect. No, after working a series of odd jobs, including as a stewardess, a department store buyer, and a property underwriter in Los Angeles, Anne converted to Mormonism, like you do. Then she moved to Northumberland to live with her family, where, according to Anne's brother, she got the idea for her first book from their stepfather, who suggested that she write about Jack the Ripper. Some sources say Anne published her first novel in 1974. Others say 1979. Either way, Anne Perry went on to become a well-known mystery author and published more than 100 novels over her 35-year career. I guess you could say she left her past, if not murder, behind her. In 1994, New Zealand director Peter Jackson released the film he co-wrote with his wife Fran Walsh, Heavenly Creatures, a movie that came out just around the time I was, if you catch my drift. It played a huge part in my queer upbringing and remains required watching for any young queer gal. Yes, they were murderers, but holy cow, it's a sexy movie. The film was based on the murder of Honora Parker, the idea from which stemmed from Walsh's fascination with the case. Heavenly Creatures starred a young Melanie Lynskey as Pauline Parker and a young Kate Winslet as Juliet Hume. The movie, which received multiple Oscar nominations, was a hit and effectively launched the mainstream success and lengthy careers of Jackson, Lynskey, and Winslet. New Zealand On Screen said, quote, "Peter Jackson's mainstream respectability was born from writer Fran Walsh's long interest in the Parker-Hume case. Two 1950s teens who invented imaginary worlds, wrote under imaginary personas, and murdered Pauline Parker's mother. Jackson and Walsh's vision of friendship, creativity, and tragedy was greeted with Oscar nominations, deals with indie company Miramax, and rhapsodic acclaim for newbie actors Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet. Time magazine and 30 other publications named it one of the year's 10 best films." End quote. Heavenly Creatures changed lives, and one of those lives was Anne Perry's, formerly Juliet Hume. Anne found out about the movie, she said, only days before it was released. The New Zealand Herald quoted her, "I thought I would lose everything. I thought it would kill my mother, the truth coming out after so long. I thought it would ruin my career, end everything. Suddenly I was thrown back all those years. I thought, am I ever to be forgiven?" She also said that to her surprise, her identity being made public did not actually cost her any relationships and actually improved her book sales. Anne went on to win an Edgar Award in 2000 and sold over 26 million books worldwide. According to her obituary in The Guardian, Anne's books, quote, "were invariably concerned with issues of social injustice, drawing to some extent on the experiences that led up to her own imprisonment. As a minor, I wasn't allowed to speak, and I heard all those lies being told," she said. "Nobody bothered to talk to me." Detectives in her novels often give voice to those who are otherwise ignored, end quote. The obituary also stated, quote, "Perry's books grapple with questions of sin and repentance, the price of redemption and forgiveness. It is vital for me to go on exploring moral matters," she says. This series, more literary and epic in scope than her pacey earlier novels, will look at personal morality against the background of that 5 years of war when things were so changed for men and women. "I wanted to explore what people will do when faced with experiences and inner conflicts that test them to the limit," end quote. In a 1994 interview with New Zealand TV3, Anne claimed she had participated in the murder out of a, quote, "misplaced loyalty to Pauline, than with devotion to their shared fantasies," end quote. She went on to say, "I felt that I was running out on a person who stood by me when I was in trouble with illness and hospital, and that I was betraying her by just leaving and doing nothing. I really believed that if I didn't take her with us, that she would take her own life, and I made a very, very wrong decision. In a 2006 interview with the Glasgow Herald, Perry asked, "Do you think the day will ever come when I am judged for my work alone? Will I ever be judged for what I am and not for what I was?" Zhao Liu, the author of the New Zealand Women's Weekly article from 1997, said, quote, "I became fascinated by the case after seeing Peter Jackson's 1994 movie Heavenly Creatures. Like many journalists, I began investigating what became of Pauline Parker after Juliet Hume was revealed to be murder mystery writer Anne Perry. There was considerable sympathy for Pauline and a strong reaction to Perry's suggestion that she only took part because she feared Pauline would commit suicide," end quote. For what it's worth, Anne's brother Jonathan never believed these narratives. Following her death in 2023, Jonathan gave an interview about his sister. He described her as a complex character and no doubt a talented writer, but there remained a streak of dishonesty and selfishness in her, as well as bossy and imaginative. She did not regard herself as being psychotic or being mad, but it was pretty clear to me looking at it. He believed Anne was a, quote, "teenager wrapped up, absorbed with the moment, not thinking it through," end quote. Jonathan felt that Anne minimized her involvement in the murder by blaming Pauline, claiming she did it to save her friend's life. He felt that while she admitted guilt, she never truly felt remorse. She was, according to Jonathan, quote, "just as psychotic later in life as she was earlier," end quote. Jonathan said these things in his interview alongside a number of other things that painted Anne as a complex and intriguing person. He wanted, he said, to set the record straight about who Anne really was. "My hope is that we can get a balanced but correct and realistic portrayal of Anne, good and bad." But what became of Pauline Parker? Following her release from prison in 1959, Pauline, now Hilary Nathan, converted to Catholicism and joined a convent for a time. She ultimately found she wasn't a good fit. How do you solve a problem like matricide, am I right? She studied at Auckland University and graduated with her BA in 1964 and worked as a librarian in Wellington for about a year before she moved to England in 1965 when her release became unconditional. She worked as a librarian in London for a short time before leaving the profession altogether. She eventually settled in a small village in Kent and ran a horseback riding school for children. Unlike Anne Perry's, Hillary's real identity was not discovered for several years following the release of Heavenly Creatures. According to the Parker Hume murder exclusive in New Zealand Women's Weekly, journalist Chris Cook became interested in finding her after seeing an interview with Anne Perry. Quote, "In a methodical search, Cook tracked Pauline to Britain. Now age 58, she is known as Hilary Nathan, a name she took after her release from prison. Living in the village of Hoo, just out of the historic city of Rochester in Kent, she runs a riding school for children. She declined to speak with us directly, but her sister Wendy told us about Hilary's new life," end quote. Cook visited Hilary Nathan's home to try to talk to her directly. Quote, "Hilary Nathan was shocked when I knocked on her door and asked her if we could talk about the events of 1954. I've never had another name. I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person," was her reaction when asked about her past as Pauline Parker. Her initial reluctance was no surprise, considering she had hidden her past for more than 40 years, end quote. Unlike Anne, Hilary had deliberately kept a low profile, being described as a hermit by some. Since she refused to speak with Cook, he spoke with her sister Wendy. Quote, "Wendy says Hilary failed in a bid to become a nun, but now she is a nun in her way, living in solitude. She's deeply religious. She leads a very unusual existence. She hasn't got a TV or a radio. She would never have heard what Anne Perry had to say, and she wouldn't care," end quote. Wendy, who said that her sister knew she was giving the interview, also said that Hilary had not seen and would not see Heavenly Creatures. Hilary just wanted to be left alone, to keep living a quiet life. Maybe the detail that, to me, implies the most growth or change in both girls once they were out of prison and living their lives as independent women is that they never met again. Contrary to the fabled idea that they were forbidden by the courts to communicate with one another, there were no post-unconditional release restrictions of that kind. The two women simply chose never to reunite. They never, as far as I know, sent letters or reached out to each other in any way. This is such a departure from the desperate need they seem to have to be together at the time of the murder. This is so remote from the idea that they were lovers, blinded by their obsession with each other and hell-bent on remaining linked. It is a complete shift in the narrative of Pauline and Juliet. Had they been the star-crossed lovers the prosecution in their trial made them out to be? At the trial, Juliet denied that she had a sexual relationship with Pauline. She was quoted as saying, "How could we? We're both women." Of course, she had everything to gain at that time by denying such a relationship with Pauline, but later, as Anne Perry, she also publicly and emphatically denied these rumors. The Crime Library piece about the murder discusses their storied lesbian relationship. Quote, "It must be noted that there is no incontrovertible evidence that Hume and Parker ever became lovers. In an interview with the newspaper, The Press, in 1994, Hume, who has since become a Mormon and rechristened herself Anne Perry, denied that there was ever any overtly sexual component of their relationship. Pauline was a really good friend, Perry told the newspaper. We had all sorts of romantic dreams. I like women very much as friends, but for romance, give me men." Hillary's sister Wendy, too, said she believed that the rumors of a lesbian relationship were, quote, rubbish, when she was interviewed by Chris Cook. But people believe what they want to believe, and as reformed, very religious adults, it makes sense that a queer past that is directly connected to the worst, most defining event of their lives wouldn't be at the top of the list of things either woman or their families would want to address, acknowledge, or remember. But people are complicated. I keep saying that, and if it isn't a fact borne out by this story, I don't know what is. The relationships of teenage girls are intense and messy and complicated. Problem with the heavenly creatures' romantic history with each other isn't its gayness. It's the binary and unnuanced way we culturally view intimacy and sexuality. It's the fact that we couldn't then and maybe still can't separate their intimacy and their violence, their possibly queer connection, and their probable instability. Maybe Anne was truthful when she said she preferred men romantically. That doesn't mean she wasn't in love with Hillary. We know Pauline dropped her early boyfriend to resume her extremely close relationship with Juliet. Perhaps they never loved each other that way, but it seems obvious that they certainly loved each other. And they also did bad things. But those two things are not mutually exclusive. Anne's brother, when interviewed after Anne's death, said that though his sister had some relationships and even numerous marriage proposals over the years, none of them were serious, and she never stayed long with any of them. Some of that was before her true identity was revealed, so she was protecting her secret by remaining isolated. But once her secret was out, she still remained alone. Anne's only long-term and serious relationship then was the morbid connection she shared with Hillary. Hillary Nathan has never, to my knowledge, spoken out about the nature of her relationship with or feelings for her accomplice. There is no way to ever really know the truth of their relationship. What we do know is that they were close, dangerously so, and their closeness was interpreted by those around them as both unhealthy, which turned out to be true, and somehow inappropriate. The possibility of their sexual and romantic involvement was used against Pauline and Juliet when they went to trial. Even though they did commit a terrible crime, these were very young women who seemed to really struggle with reality and who probably didn't need any more strikes against them. Jonathan Hume, in his interview with the New Zealand Herald, said that his sister was unstable and remained unstable for the rest of her life. Hillary Nathan's sister told the world that Hillary only wished to be left alone, She seemed to maintain stability by keeping her exposure to the wider world to a minimum. These women were not just the perpetrators of a hideous crime. They were also the lifelong victims of it. The heavenly creatures have lived a life that, while not without personal successes, seems to me far from heaven. And maybe that's as it should be. I'll leave you with Pauline's own words from the back of her diary from 1953. "There are living amongst two dutiful daughters of a man who possesses two beautiful daughters, the most glorious beings in creation. They'd be the pride and joy of any nation. You cannot know, nor try to guess, the sweet soothingness of their caress. The outstanding genius of this pair is understood by few, they are so rare. Compared with these two, every man is a fool. The world is most honored that they should deign to rule. And above us, these goddesses reign on high. I worship the power of these lovely two, with that adoring love known to so few. 'Tis indeed a miracle, one must feel, that two such heavenly creatures are real. Both sets of eyes, though different far, hold many mysteries strange. Impassively they watch the race of man decay and change. Hatred burning bright in the brown eyes, with enemies for fuel. Icy scorn glitters in the grey eyes, contemptuous and cruel. Why are men such fools they will not realize the wisdom that is hidden behind those strange eyes? And these wonderful people are you and I." Next time on Strange and Unexplained. Sometimes, when a person is in great peril and the situation looks dire, help can show up in the most unexpected ways. Whether it's a guardian angel, a guiding spirit, or just an imaginary friend, turns out we might never actually walk alone. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Guardet, sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine, music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.